And we're back. All right, another deep dive segment. Now, let me start this one. This is our U.S. dollar deep dive segment, and this has prompted me and it's reminded me to send a little text to my good friend of the show, Mr. Brent Johnson, Santiago Capital. He's been on the show several times, but it's been a while, and Brent has done an extensive amount of work, and I really respect his work, and I really like him as a guy, and respect him as an investor. But he's done a ton of work on this, and he's taught me a lot. And it's actually the reason that we had Brent on in the first place is he was the only guy talking about a strong dollar and the dangers of a strong dollar. Now, we've put this under the deep dive segment, but I'm primarily doing this to explain to the people that have maybe missed those segments, explain to the audience, especially in Portland, that we haven't done a deep dive onto the U.S. dollar since we've been joined into the Portland family, and it's important, and it's certainly a prescient topic. Never at a time in my career have I had as many people and as many clients asking me about inflation. And to lay out the story and to tell you why I've come to where I've come on this issue, I got to start at the beginning. So first of all, I grew up in a family, as many of you know, my father and grandfather started a brokerage firm in 1983. So we say you come by the business, honestly, my mom's literally got pictures of me in a diaper playing in a mud puddle at a gold mining project, in a playpen in a brokerage office. And the reason I was playing in a diaper at a gold mining operation was because they had a brokerage firm, but they weren't really focused as much on managing retirement assets or anything like that. They were doing a lot of venture capital investing into natural resource plays, gold, silver, oil, things of that nature. And the big driver for why they were doing that was because, you know, 1980, 1982, 1983, the big inflation that we had, right? And it looked like it wasn't going to slow down, and it was a trend that had been, you know, 13 years in the making. And over that period of time, gold had rallied from $35 to $900. And all of the inflationistas that you hear out there right now talking about a hyperinflation, the collapse of the U.S. dollar, and pause there, because I think eventually they'll be proven right. And it's just a matter of simple logic, right? If you continue to print a good with no end, eventually that good is going to lose money. And the same will be true of the dollar. The problem is if you don't get the timing right on that call, you're going to get killed. And I know because it's happened to me. Okay, so when I grew up in this environment, my grandfather actually had published work on this. He's actually the author of a New York Times bestseller, too. Very brilliant guy. But he was big in the inflation, that Jimmy Carter's going to collapse the dollar, and he made a substantial amount of money in precious metals. And I remember seeing a shoebox full of older nickels that were actually made out of silver. And I didn't think back then, and I still don't think now, that was crazy. I think keeping inflation hedges in your portfolio at all times is prudent for a whole variety of reasons. But it gives you a different perspective when you hear about the inflation and the collapsing of our dollar and the debt coming down on us, and you hear about that for 15, 20 years and you never see it happen. And then we went into 2007, 2008, and we all quickly came to the realization of, oh my goodness, they just blew a hole in the side of this economy, you know, in the side of this economy, the size of a Mack truck. And they're just going to print over it, right? They're just going to fill in the hole. And then you see $900 billion come out in the TARP plan. And then you see the Fed launch something called QE. which I remember the day it was announced. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, but I'd never even heard of it. I had no clue what they were talking about. And in all reality, it was just kind of another flip around. If you've seen the documentary, and if you haven't seen it, a fascinating documentary on Japan and what happened there. If you want to know why Japan has gone through 30 years of deflation and their stock market is still, what is it, 30% off its all-time high that was set in 1989? So if you invested in the stock market, the Japanese stock market in 1989, you're still sitting on a 30% loss. 31, 32 years later. It's crazy, right? But if you want to see a really good documentary on this, it's called The Princes of the Yen. And if you watch that documentary, you'll sit there and go, Zach, they were doing something totally different. The Bank of Japan, they were doing something called window dressing. I believe it was window dressing. Anyway, something window. Yeah, it's window dressing. I've heard people refer to it as other terms, but I believe the term they use in the documentary is window dressing. So they weren't necessarily at that point buying bonds. Now, they've done it all at this point. Shoot, the Bank of Japan now owns, what, they're a top 10 shareholder in 90% of stocks on the Nikkei exchange. They own something like 92% of all Japanese government bonds. So they've engaged in straight QE. But initially, they worked off of what they referred to as window dressing, which was basically the mandate of loan issuance. So the Bank of Japan would look at a bank and say, look, this quarter, you've got to lend out $2 billion, right? Or whatever the case may be. But if you think about it, it's kind of the same thing just through a different mechanism, right? You're forcing the issuing of debt. The Fed is doing the same thing. They're just doing it on the flip side of it, right? They're doing it from the demand side. They're buying up all the debt, which then means that those banks or investors have to turn around and buy more, right? So I think the Fed's approach is probably more efficacious, and it's probably more practical. It's also freer, you're not making people sell them to you. But in essence, I think that it does the same thing. It promotes the issuance of debt without necessarily caring as much as you should about credit quality. And there are bigger differences. I'm summarizing here, but that's a good way to look at it. But anyway, so when we saw and knowing that, you know, growing up where I did and knowing that story about the Japanese, you know, we saw the Fed launch QE, and I remember going, what in the heck is it? And then digging down into it and going, oh my gosh, this is like window dressing, but this is even crazier. They're going to print the money out of thin air. And they're going to buy up assets in the open market. They're going to print the money, 50, 60, 70, 80 billion a month, which seemed nuts back then. We're buying 120 billion a month right now. But I was sitting there going, holy smokes, it's happening. The inflationary depression, right? Or the inflationary craziness, the collapse of the US dollar. This is the beginning of that move. This is it. So we actually did really well. We were up about, oh, shoot, I don't know, is 15 to 20% during the financial crisis. I think it was 21. It's a long time ago, though. And I will admit to you that I'm always cautious about citing performance over time. And I feel kind of embarrassed to admit this, but I've often caught myself saying that the performance was slightly better than it was. And I go back and look and go, oh, geez, you need to correct that. It's not on purpose. Maybe it's just trying to make up over the cracks, you know. And so I think it was 21% we made from the end of 2007. And I think I've told you guys before, we thought that the housing market was going to collapse. I didn't think the market was going to drop 63%. I didn't think Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns were going to go under. I just thought the market would get hit and treasuries would be a good place, safe place to hide. I didn't think my treasuries would go up by 20% because Lehman Brothers collapsed and created a liquidity crisis. So we got some luck to go our way. Anyway, my point of that is that we were in a great place coming out of that. Obviously, we'd massively outperformed the S&P in a manner that, you know, you'd had to try really hard to give back over the next several years. But we saw all this happening coming out of the financial crisis. And so what I did at the time is I loaded up on precious metals. I loaded up on precious metals miners. And now we were managing a lot less money back then, but that portfolio was up just, I think it was a little over 100% over the next 14 months. So we were up 21% or 20%, 15 to 20 to be safe, during the financial crisis. And then coming out of it, we had this just rip, And it was because the commodities bounced back. The gold miners were flying high. Gold was going to the roof. And here it comes. And I remember for the next year and a half watching the inflation prints come out, and the inflation wasn't happening. I wasn't seeing gas go to the moon. I wasn't seeing it. It wasn't showing up. And it was seriously frustrating and puzzling. And by the end of 2011, and this is another lucky break, I'll come right out and tell you, it was lucky. I was beginning to get very concerned about the lack of inflation showing up. And I was more concerned about the fact that I was completely perplexed and felt out over my skis. Now, at that point, gold was still right by its record highs. So I was also feeling kind of arrogant about the fact that, yeah, I might be a little confused, but, you know, look at the performance, right? So thank God, being pretty perplexed and confused as to what was happening, I scaled way back on our exposure into precious metals until I had a better feel for what was going on. And I think most of us know what happened. Over the next, what is it, 3 or 4 years, gold basically got cut in half. And don't quote me on this, but gold miners went through a nuclear winter. I mean, they lost 90% and then lost 90% again. It was ugly. And they're still getting over it. I mean, it was bad. No projects got built. No projects got financed. There are less mines open today than there were 10 years ago. If I remember the numbers correctly, I believe it was by far and away the worst precious metals bull market, especially when compared to other financial assets that we'd ever seen. And if it wasn't up there, you know, if it wasn't number one, it was number two. And so we lucked out and missed out on the worst of that. We got hit in a couple positions, but it was nothing too crazy. But what it did cause, though, is it caused some serious underperformance. We didn't lose money, but we had some serious underperformance between the end of 2011 to really the beginning into 2014. Now, again, had you been with us through the whole time, your performance was still outstanding compared to the market because of the home run that we hit in 2008. But, you know, when I remember, I think it was 2013, I think our value portfolio was up like 5% and the market was up 31 or 32. As you can imagine, there were some ticked off clients and I was frustrated and I was at the end of my rope. And I'll even admit at one point during that time, it happened again, actually, in the middle of 2019. But I was considering giving up managing money. Because I wasn't going to continue to manage money if I didn't understand what was going on, but B, most importantly, if maybe my performance was just a lucky hit. And I've always felt a real pressure about being able to deliver the goods because I manage retirement money. I can't figure out how to do this job with other people's money. You know, the real life consequences are too large. Now, thank God I didn't, just because I enjoy it so much. It would have been painful, but it was something I was willing to do. End of 2019, similar. I was just so frustrated. And again, we'd done better than the value indexes. And as far as value portfolios go, the performance was really good. It just really paled in comparison to the S&P. And thank God for our momentum algorithm because it just smoked and carried the day for us. But I say all that to go back to what we were talking about as far as the U.S. dollar goes. So in 2011, it started off this exploration of mine into understanding the global financial system better, realizing that what I was saying in terms of countries printing more money and creating inflation, that makes all the sense in the world, right? And if countries persist in doing that long enough, they most certainly will experience massive currency degradation. But it wasn't occurring. And so I knew that something had to be wrong with my understanding of the system. And so I started digging. I started reading books about Bretton Woods. I started reading books about the formation of the Federal Reserve. I started listening to experts on the topic, and what I really became to understand, and this is so important, you guys, and if you're one of those people out there that's hoarding gold coins or whatever, look, I don't think owning precious metals is a bad idea. The inflation is coming. The problem is we just don't know when. And it's entirely possible that between now and when the inflation comes, you could see the dollar go parabolic. Let me explain. So an individual asset, think of housing in 2007. Were houses really going up in value like we all thought they were? Obviously not. They were getting pushed up due to artificial buyers, right? Loans being given to people that should not be getting them. Liar loans, fake loans. You had a fake source of demand, right? But the rush, the sugar rush from that lasted several years and had everybody convinced that you got to buy land because God's not making any more of it, right? We all heard that. And in a lot of ways, that's a really good example because the plumbing of that system had a lot to do with that. Those assets were being driven by the plumbing. It's not a perfect analogy, but right, the plumbing of that mortgage system was what was driving housing prices. It wasn't a natural appreciation. And what I mean by that is those things had been going up. They offered really solid yields. They were carrying AAA ratings, right? And so the demand for them was really high. They were paying higher interest than you can get in a lot of bonds. You were also diversified. You were AAA, which essentially means virtually no risk. They had the same credit rating as the U.S. government. So it meant banks could hold them on their balance sheets and not even have to report it. They could essentially hold them as cash. And so that system kept feeding on, right? It's because the more that people wanted them, the more the banks created, that made people want them even more, right? It's the plumbing of the system. Well, when you turn around and you look at the U.S. dollar, the plumbing has even a lot more to do, and it's not by accident. And to understand it, you've really got to go back to the end of World War II. But to understand what happened to World War II, or post-World War II, you got to understand what happened after World War I. So after World War I, the economies in Europe were obviously devastated, right? And Germany lost the war. And at the time, I can totally understand why they did this. But they basically said, hey, you lost, and you essentially started it. Right, certainly the most to blame. And so we're going to saddle you. Part of the peace agreement is we're going to saddle you with the cost of rebuilding. Okay, there's one problem. Germany's infrastructure was blown to smithereens, right? They'd just gone through a world war. So they had no productivity in their economy in which to pay that back. So what did the government do? And a guy by the name of Rudy Havenstein, who was the head of the Reichsbank at the time, he did what really was their only option. He started printing money. And that's what created the Weimar Republic, the hyperinflation in Germany, which eventually led to Hitler, right? And that's kind of the danger of inflation is actually far more pernicious than deflation. And you see it historically. It leads to upheaval. It leads to overthrows of empires. And it's kind of ironic how modern economists are all freaked out about deflation. My attitude is show me a currency or a country that became irrelevant due to deflation. They go, well, Japan. Like, well, they're not irrelevant. They're still, what are they, a top five, top six economy in the world? They're not irrelevant. Their culture hasn't crumbled, right? They're still a major player. They're still a wonderful place to go and clean and beautiful, you know, that doesn't count, right? What has ruined virtually every empire dating back thousands of years into the Chinese dynasties? It's inflation. And so it literally ushered in Hitler. And thank God for some wise leaders that remembered that lesson, because post-World War II, once again, you had a devastated Germany. And so they came together with the Marshall Plan, right? The rebuilding of Germany and the rebuilding of Europe. And part of that agreement, part of that larger agreement was, right, we got to pay for this somehow. Well, how do we pay for it? We got to avoid the mistakes that we made post-World War I. So who had the intact economy? The United States did. So essentially, Now, I'm making this a lot more simple than it is, but just broad strokes. Essentially, the agreement was, okay, the United States will pay for the rebuild. And these other countries, will, you know, they'll help out as they can. But the U.S. has got to shoulder the load. Now, we all know that if they're going to have to print money to do that and issue debt to do that. And we can't let their currency get killed because they're cleaning up our mess. So that's basically how the U.S. dollar became the world reserve currency. Because they went, okay, well, if the U.S. has got to pay the bill, then everybody else has to use our currency. And to make sure they do that, we're going to make it mandatory for all commodity transactions around the world to be settled in U.S. dollars. And again, this is grossly simplistic, but this gives you enough to kind of get on your way and start learning about, you know, this whole process. And that really began, you know, the dynastic rise. You know, we were already well on our way to becoming a world power, obviously. And the evidence of that is what we did in World War II. But that's really what put us at the top of the heap. That was that's you know, one of the primary reasons that we're here where we are now, is that we had this constant bid under the U.S. dollar because people had to have it. If you wanted to buy gold or metal or oil or whatever, you had to have U.S. dollars. And so unlike every currency on the world, around the world, every country around the world had to own U.S. dollars. And then when times got tight or things got scary, everybody rushed and still does to grab what? U.S. dollars. And this is why once I went through this, and this was a two and a half year study project for me. But once I went through this, I kind of came to the conclusion, okay, as long as the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency and we continue to operate under this financial system, inflation is absolutely possible and unavoidable. Hyperinflation isn't in play unless something crazy were to happen because, you know, you look at Venezuela, right? The Bolivar. Everybody knows about the insane hyperinflation they've had. Well, nobody needs to own Bolivars. Right, there's nothing to offset that you know the other side of that you know that transaction, the printing. Right, they're printing all this money. There's no country around the world that has to own bolivars. As a matter of fact, most of them probably unloaded them, making the problem worse. Right. Well, under the current monetary setup, other countries don't have that option. In order to keep the doors open, keep operating, keep their economy functioning, they have to have U.S. dollars so they can buy steel, so they can buy oil, so they can buy gold. And I know people are like, well, China and Russia can trade. China and Russia can't do anything about it. Their currency markets aren't anywhere near big enough, not anywhere near liquid enough. And China in particular has a closed current account. And the reason they do that is because if they left their currency valuation float, it would get crushed. So, and I'm just talking facts. Even if the whole world came to the conclusion that it'd be better to switch the yuan, they couldn't do it. It would set off chaos. So in my view, and I think history bears this out, it's the structure of the system. Everybody keeps looking at the dollar and they're not looking at the plumbing. The system was designed to prevent hyperinflation. The system was literally designed to let us be profligate in the face of others' austerity and still maintain our currency valuation. And to that end, the system has been pretty successful. Now, the flip side to that is there's a vulnerability to the global financial system that nobody, including myself, I shouldn't say nobody, the vast majority of the investment world, including myself, didn't and still hasn't paid attention to. Which is, okay, everybody has to have U.S. dollars, right? And another thing that has resulted in is a lot of countries will lend to each other, but they don't trust each other's currencies. So they denominate those contracts or they denominate those loans in U.S. dollars. Well, what does that create? That creates even more U.S. dollar liability, which requires whoever is lending the money, the borrower, it requires them every month or every quarter to have to go and get U.S. dollars to service that U.S. dollar denominated debt. And when the economy starts to go sideways, they start hoarding dollars, not just to buy commodities, but to ensure that they can price pay for the value of their debt. Think about it. If you go through a really nasty crack up, considering all the money printed out there in the world, okay, and things get dicey, do people rather have their money in, you know, Vietnam, or would they rather have in the United States? They'd rather have in the United States. So they sell their assets in Vietnam in that local currency, right, making that currency go down. And they move their assets to the United States and they convert them to U.S. dollars and U.S. dollar denominated assets. Right? Price of the dollar goes up. And that's the way it's worked. And that's the way it continues to work. And so now you've got not only the demand of commodities. We all know how much debt is out there in the world. And you just need to know that the vast majority of not just the debt in the United States, but the debt around the world is denominated in U.S. dollars. Exponentially more so than any other currency. So that means when tough times hit, the rush for dollars is getting bigger as the debt grows. Because what does debt do? It's like cancer. It just continues to grow. And so, yes, the Fed is printing a ton of money, but dollar liabilities around the world are growing at a faster pace. I don't know if they are right now or in the last year. I still think they're even over the last year, despite all the printing, I think dollar-denominated liabilities went up even more. Don't quote me on that, but they have over the past, you know, 10 years. So the reason you're not seeing a hyperinflation has nothing to do with the profligacy of the U.S. government. It has to do with the plumbing and the structure of the system. Now, that does not mean we can't get higher inflation prints. I think those are on the way. And what brought this to my attention was having a conversation with a very intelligent younger family member of mine that listens to Peter Schiff a lot. And if you guys don't know who Peter Schiff is, he's a smart guy, runs an investment firm, had some very prescient calls on the housing collapse in 2007. And ever since then, continuing to this day, is lockstep with my thinking from 2009 to 2011 of we're printing all this money and hyperinflation's coming. And he looked at me, we were talking about it. He's like, you know, Peter Schiff, hyperinflation coming and everything's going to crash. And I looked at him, I go, think about what you just said. You said the value of the dollar is going to crash, so the price of assets denominated in U.S. dollars is going to crash. That's not how inflation works. Now, if the value of the dollar, the threat to inflation is right, the degradation of the currency to the point where even pay raises to people, right, their pay cannot increase at a rate that's commensurate with the devaluation of the currency, meaning no matter how much harder they work or promotions they get, their standard of living continues to drop. That's when people revolt, right? That's when things get thrown over. No matter what I do, I'm still losing. And you can understand why. And you can understand why those inflationary scenarios are even more so unsteady than the deflationary collapses. But my whole point is saying you have to pay attention. I bought it for decades. I get the simple, clean, you know, surgical logic of we're printing all this money. The value of the dollar is going to go to nothing. In a vacuum, that's exactly how it would work. But you're working inside of a financial system that was specifically designed to prevent that. And it's proven pretty dang effective. And if you don't believe me, go look at the deficit spending and the debt issuance of our country, and then go look at the value of the U.S. dollar. I think going into last year, the DXY was right around 90, or going into 2020, it was right around 92. It got as high as 106. It's back down to 93. You know, that's not a small move for a currency, but think about what we've done. Think about the record deficits. And to call it record is crazy, but I mean, just because it's so beyond anything comparable. Think about the money that's been spent and the stimulus and now the infrastructure. The dollar went to 106 and is back to 93. Does that look like a currency that's about ready to collapse? Should it? Probably. But it's the structure of the underlying system. And this is why we have to be so careful who we listen to. Do we need to be worried about inflation? Absolutely. But guys, we're not out of the woods yet, because what did we also say? Look at all the debt that's piled up on corporate balance sheets, on government balance sheets, on personal balance. Personal balance sheets are actually a little bit cleaner, but go look at corporate balance sheets. Right? I mean, it's ballooned in the last year and a half. And the reason that's important is, guys, the bigger the stack of debt, the bigger the deflationary threat. And I want to get something really clear, too. Around the world, if people are worried about a falling U.S. dollar, if it falls too fast or precipitously, obviously that's a problem. But I got to tell you, if the dollar pulled back 15 to 20%, which would be a massive move, but let's say the dollar dropped 15 to 20% over the next year and a half, guys, that's not even close to a hyperinflationary rate. I think hyperinflation is defined by, like, is it 25% plus more? It's something like that. I think the official, and it doesn't really matter, right? But I think it's like 25% a month or something like that is considered hyperinflation. So if you devalue the dollar by 15 to 20% over the next 2 years, I'll tell you what would happen. Most likely, very likely, asset prices all over the world would go ballistic. You'd see emerging markets go through the roof. And why? Right, because the dollar has dropped in value compared to their currency, so that means buying U.S. dollars to fund the growth of their, you know, to then use those dollars to buy steel and to buy, right? You know, if their currency, if their local currency was trading at a 40% discount to the U.S. dollar, now all of a sudden everything else is the same, and now they're only at a 20%. You know, discount to the U.S. dollar. That gives them a lot more buying power. And that's why we've always said that the beginning of inflation feels like a party. It feels great in the beginning. And it's a lot like a high school party, right? It's a blast in the beginning. You just don't want to stay there past midnight. Things get ugly. And so before you listen to these charlatans, and I don't mean that. I'm not calling Peter Schiff a charlatan. I actually, in a way, I tip my cap to him because he's been remarkably consistent. The only problem is if you're early on an investment call for 13 years, you're wrong, right? If you're early for 13 years, you're wrong. And he won't re-examine. I've heard him talk a million times. He just repeats the same thing over and over again. And I agree with his logic. He's just not including the fact that the plumbing was designed to prevent that from happening. And until that plumbing is changed, I have a really hard time seeing the dollar collapse. And as a matter of fact, that's not the big threat. When you consider the existing dollar function, right? When you consider the plumbing of the financial system globally, a higher dollar is the threat. A higher dollar is what kills growth in emerging markets and international markets. Look at the value of the dollar and how steady and rock stable it has been despite our massive deficits over the last 13 years. Now go look at the performance of emerging markets and international markets and commodities. You'll see it. They've been horrible. There's been record underperformance of international and emerging market stocks when compared to U.S. because there's been a strong dollar. And it's the plumbing. It's the makeup of the system. It's the structure itself that is creating that. And that will break, because here's the thing. The people on the other side saying those things about China and Russia, they have a really good point when it comes to, you can understand China and Russia's frustration. Wait a second. You guys get to run record deficits because of an agreement that was made almost 80 years ago? And you don't have to face pressures on your currency, even though you just spent, you know, 35 or 40% of your GDP in the form of deficit spending in a single year? You're passing out money like it's playing cards to all your citizens, to the tune where the average income actually rises in an economic shutdown, and your currency doesn't drop? That's not fair. And I don't agree with them. I think that rebuilding Europe kind of earned us that right. Now, I think we've certainly stretched it to the max, and probably exceeded the max, but I can certainly understand their frustration. And eventually that frustration will spill over and there will be another financial system. But as long as the system is built like this, hyperinflation really isn't possible. And if the dollar devalues enough in this system, guess what it does? It makes American goods cheaper and they become more attractive, and you could see manufacturing begin to move back to the United States at even a greater pace than it is now. Now, you take us out of the world reserve currency stature and you put in a new system where all currencies are on equal footing, and things could get dicey. And they would, in my opinion. Maybe not immediately, but they would, because now it doesn't have the underpinnings of the financial system. And people go, well, Zach, those things were all in place in 1971, and look at the depreciation of the U.S. dollar over that period of time. Well, yeah, but we went off the gold standard, right? That was a transition from hard-backed currencies to fiat currencies. That adjustment should have happened. And then consequently, the rest of the world did too, so it didn't even matter anymore, right? Their currencies depreciated right down to where I was, and we just discovered a new currency equilibrium at a lower level. Or not even a lower level. That's the other thing people need to realize. When you sit there and talk about a currency being up or down, what you're talking about typically is that currency in relationship to other currencies. So what that means is you'd be like, oh, the dollar's gone up 6% in the last year versus other currencies. And yet at the same time, you could still have really nasty inflation. Right? Dollar goes up 60% against the other currencies, and oil and lumber and natural gas go up 80% versus the dollar. But my whole point is saying that you have to look at the system. You have to look at the structure because it matters. It's piping. It's how money flows through systems. You can't just arbitrarily say you're printing money, therefore you're going to lose value. And I really wish it was that simple. And the reason I know this to be true, because I was wrong. So why am I confident in it now? Because once I got that concept, I started thinking about, okay, if the Fed has this unlimited ability to print, I skipped over something. The other reason why we never saw the inflation that I was expecting coming out of the financial crisis is, once again, another, I didn't understand the plumbing. The Federal Reserve was buying up assets, but they were buying up assets from the bank, and they would deposit the money into the reserve account at the bank. That money didn't get out into the hands of consumers. It pushed rates down, which encouraged money to get out in the hands of consumers, but that money did not have an active path or conduit to feed directly into the economy. For the most part, it was just sitting on the bank's reserve accounts at the Federal Reserve. So yeah, they were printing money, but it's kind of like a tree falling in the forest. If that money doesn't actually get out into the economy, it's not going to cause inflation. Now, it stayed in the financial system, which is why we had, in my opinion, the slowest decade of real growth on record, including the Great Depression, and yet we still saw the S&P appreciate something like 380%. Right? I think quantitative easing had a direct impact on asset prices, but not real inflation. Well, that's what's scary about what's happened over the last year and a half, is we've left that kind of sterile quantitative easing, money not getting into the financial system, where we're printing the dough and shoving it right down people's throats. So I would expect higher inflation, but I wouldn't expect hyperinflation. Because the plumbing of the old system is still in play. When things start going sideways, people have to run to dollars, not because they think we're so smart and not because they think we're so fiscally disciplined. They've got no choice. They got to service their debt and they've got to be able to buy commodities. And so the real scary thing to me is the dollar going up. Think back to March. Things were going crazy. The dollar was up over 106. You got much higher than that, 4, 5, 6, 7% higher than that, I think things really would have started to break. Because what happens when the dollar starts getting too strong? Remember how we were talking about the dollar being weak is beneficial to the rest of the world? Okay, what happens if we're going through a horrible, you know, going through an economic downturn, right? And those other countries around the world whose economies are slowing down too, Now their currency is also dropping in relationship to the dollar. So not only are they getting lower productivity and making less money and getting less tax revenue because of the slowdown in the economy, but they're getting the double whammy because their currency that they have to use to buy more commodities has just depreciated 20 to 25% in relationship to the dollar. So they're getting double whacked, right? They're getting whacked on the economic slowdown, and they're getting whacked on the fact that their currency buys 25% less in dollar terms. And so what do they have to do? They got to print more money to make up that shortfall, which pushes the value of their currency even lower, and it creates this vicious cycle, pushing the dollar higher, pushing their currencies lower. And if you let that go unchecked, that is the fault of this system. The fault of this system, the breaking point in this system is dollar strength. No, I don't think they're ever going to let that happen. I think they're eventually going to transition to a system where that's no longer the weakness. But you got to have one or the other. So at that point, the weakness, at least for us in the United States, would be the potential of serious hyperinflation. But I'm just telling you, if you're at home worried about all the spending and debt, you should be. It's insane. And we and the piper will get paid. He always does. But if you think you're going to see scenes like out of the Weimar Republic, you know, by next Christmas time, if you think that people are going to be stealing, you know, your grocery cart full of cash and dumping the cash out on the sidewalk and taking the cart or the wheelbarrow, it's an anecdotal story that came out of that Weimar Republic time, you're going to be sorely disappointed. The system won't allow it. So I'll cut it off there. I'm going to get Brent Johnson on so we can deep dive into this even deeper because he is more of an expert on this topic than I am. Oh, and then the actionable side of it. Okay, so I want to say the first way I really tried this premise was through this research possibility, I started thinking to myself, okay, because there is not this constraint of inflation, right, when it comes to central banks printing money, because there isn't this constraint of inflation, how will you know when the rubber's about to hit the road? How will you know when things are about to get really dicey? And the conclusion I came to was a really good sign of that occurring will be when the U.S. dollar and gold rally together. Okay. And then I started thinking about the condition. This is about middle of 2015 when I came to these conclusions. And I started thinking about gold particularly. And gold had been killed, right? It was down to like 1050 at the time. And the Fed was talking in the end of 2015 about raising rates for the first time. And everybody says you got to buy gold because gold goes down when rates go up. Well, historically, we knew that was nonsense, right? Nominally speaking, the previous high in gold all time, you know, on an inflation adjusted basis was 1979 or 1980 when gold hit $900 an ounce. And interest rates were substantially higher then, right? And interest rates and gold rose together. Now, if people are talking about if real rates are going higher, then that has been bad for gold. But typically speaking, higher rates signal higher inflation, which is typically good for gold. But, you know, you get this narrative going on through the market that rate increases equal lower gold. And so everybody was expecting the first rate increase. And so gold just kept going down, 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 down. And I thought, you know what? This is the classic time where you buy the rumor and you sell the you sell the rumor and you buy the news. And what I mean by that is when the first rate hike happens, that's when you want to buy gold. So I said, okay, what I'm going to do to test this theory out is I'm going to wait till the first rate hike hits. And if gold is positive the 2 days following that rate hike, I'm going to press into it. So the first rate hike came, I believe, December 15th of 2015. Gold was solidly positive the 2 days right after that rate hike. We went hard into gold miners. And over the next 3 months, gold rallied 25% and the gold miners were up over 100. And I sat there and I went, okay. Now I feel like I'm getting my groove back. Now I feel like not only do I cognitively starting to understand how this system is working, but I'm also starting to be able to convey it, or I'm also starting to be able to implement that in our investment strategies, and we're seeing fruit from that. So then the next thing I started thinking about was that the real sign of duress will be when the dollar and gold are rising together. And I came to that conclusion because I thought, okay, some people will, they're going to need dollars, but they've also got to be concerned about our money printing and our profligate spending. So what is one of the best ways to sanitize U.S. dollar risk? To buy gold. Right. So I thought they'd have to load up on U.S. dollars, and then to hedge that risk, they'd have. Now, maybe they buy tips or whatever. I'm speaking generally. But that was my thesis at the time. Well, sure enough, the volatility complex blew up in the beginning of 2018. And then what did we see starting from 2018? I think this is fascinating because of some of the signs of economic slowdown that were going on in 2018. And to be fair, at the end of 2019, despite all the talk of a roaring economy, it wasn't weak. But it looked as if the growth or the momentum of the economy had peaked. It wasn't free falling. I'm not saying a recession was imminent, but a lot of recessionary indicators started popping up at the last of, or slowdown indicators, probably be the best way to put it, started showing up at the end of 2019 as well. And then the dollar and gold really continued to rise until the problems with COVID hit. And then the dollar skyrocketed and the gold went back to a new all-time high of 2050. Right? That doesn't make any sense either. Dollar and gold rising together. What I'm saying is, this is my point. Eventually, those realities, in my opinion, will play out. But in the interim, the function of the system itself is overriding the underlying fundamentals. You could make an argument the same is happening in the stock market. But here's the thing, guys. This can last a lot longer. I don't think we're years out. I mean, when I say years, I'm more than 5 years out, but we could be. And that's why I kind of laugh when I hear these guys go, well, we're positioned for inflation or we're positioned for deflation. I just think that that's silly because either or could happen. It's extraordinarily hard to handicap that. And if you're really a fiduciary's manager of fiduciary, if you're really a fiduciary for your client's money, you'd better darn well be protected and prepared for both. So anyway, we'll cut it off there. I hope that sheds some more light on it. We're going to get Brent Johnson on to deep dive into this with me. Because again, I know we have a lot more followers. I know we're in Portland now, and I think this could be efficacious. I think it's something that's really important that investors really need to understand. Because I think understanding, I've said this many times, understanding the interplay between inflation and deflation and the signs of both and how bad both can get and how to hedge against those risks, I think it's going to be paramount in your investment outcomes over the next 10 years. So anyway, we got to run. Have a great day. We'll be back next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.